Okay, this is the California Violent Video Games panel. We're going to talk about the Supreme Court case. If you could, folks, if you could please introduce yourself and get started.
My name's Andrew Greenberg. I am a professional game developer. I've been developing games since 1990 as a living. In addition, before that, I was a reporter for a legal affairs newspaper here in Atlanta called the Fulton County Daily Report. Report on courts for a while. Write a chapter for the Matthew Bender legal series on the interactive entertainment industry. And for those of you, how many industry professionals are in the audience? Game industry professionals. Yeah, we got a few. We have a convention here in Georgia, October 1st to 3rd, Siege, the Southern Interactive Entertainment Game Expo, siegecon.net, which is for professionals talking about development industries, development issues, and I'm the director of that.
My name is Brian Green. I'm also often known by my online pseudonym Psychochild. I've been developing MMOs since 98. I helped edit a book on business and legal issues. Called a Primer for Business and Legal Issues in the Game Industry, I think it was creatively called. So,
I'm Blake Sorensen. I'm a patent attorney, primarily on the business law side of things. So where Chris actually gets to go into a courtroom from time to time, I sit in an office and read documents and write reports all day.
It has more fun.
But he's also a game developer. Don't let him kid you. He's snuck into the industry a bit, too.
Yeah, I've written a few of those really long-winded legal documents that you ignore and click, I accept.
So I might have the fun of being the only one on this panel who's been accused in print and so and in other places for having published violent games that led kids to kill each other. That was actually not primarily for the computer games, that's for the paper games like Vampire the Masquerade and Eternal Struggle. The card game actually got some stuff blamed on it. We got some good ones back in the day. But want to start by analyzing the case? We're talking about the history of violent video games law. We're getting people to pass us drinks. Or applauding that he got through the door in that outfit.
Yeah, that's impressive.
Wow.
I guess the first thing is make sure we all know and we're all talking about the same law and the same cases. So we're talking about video software dealers and ESA v. Schwarzenegger and some other guy, Eben Brown, who is Attorney General of California based on some California law that tried to criminalize the sale of violent video games to minors. Basically, they were trying to criminalize any depiction of torture, murder, dismemberment, blah, 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 or anything that using the obscenity standard, a reasonable person would find to be morbid or so forth. Basically, but violent video games.
But now it's basically Schwarzenegger against all of us. And if you watch Terminator, you know we're in trouble. But but like every other law that's tried to limit what games can be sold and can't be sold and so forth, this one has been struck down through the courts. The ESA, the Electronic Software Association, has been very proud of its record in defeating any bills that would limit our ability to buy and play games freely. And the concern on this one is this is the first one to have reached the Supreme Court. And there's, while a lot of people in the industry think this is a wonderful moment to clearly define that people can't ban games, there's also a bit of fear that five justices can decide it's time to ban games.
Right. I think that's definitely the kind of the issue that we're looking at is that usually when there's a law that challenges this, the usual way to defeat it is that even though a lot of these laws try to protect children, it unduly restricts access to the media to adults too. So I think that, personally as a game developer, obviously, I think that it's important for children not to be, if parents don't want their children to be exposed to violent media. It's important that they have the tools to be able to do that. And I think we really do adequately have the tools, the ESRB with the game ratings. I think, if parents learn about that, they can be just as useful as movie ratings.
And I guess I should jump in on the other side here and say, despite knowing that I'm probably against the majority of the audience, that the law does not necessarily prevent parents from allowing their kids to play these games. The law restricts the sale of the game to a minor. There's nothing in the law that stops a parent from buying the game for the child.
Right. Yeah, this definitely is against the game shop or seller. But on the other hand, the cost of telling the 17-year-old from the 18-year-old, the game seller may decide that was just prohibitive, and they're just not going to screw with it.
And of course, we as the designers, it becomes a chilling effect on what you put in games. If you want to sell to a more general audience, you've got to take out stuff that might be approved, but you're worried about it all the way through. My favorite story involving the ESRB is one that actually my company, Holistic Design, went through with them, where we published this wonderful game, Merchant Prince. We've done some later versions of it, and one of the later versions we're publishing, it's a wonderful game of the Renaissance era, politics and trading, wherein you can have yourself elected to the College of Cardinals, assassinate the Pope, become elected Pope, you can spread the Black Plague through Europe, you can kill thousands and millions all in the name of profit. So we expected an E for everyone rating, of course. But we got some pushback from the ESRB on that one, because it's not for being able to kill most of Europe. It is because you can slander your opponents, and we put the little insults in there. We tore a lot of Shakespearean insults on there. You have the French pox, stuff like that, which all went through fine. But the ESRB objected to one in particular. If you have children here, you might want to cover their ears, because obviously they can't hear this sort of thing. But they... And just so you know, that was the main programmer on Merchant Prince who's responsible for this actually being in the game. Okay, it was Ed who made it up. But the one slander which they objected to was, you are a pocket fisherman. And for that, we're at risk of not getting an E rating. So my favorite ESRB story about how they will protect children, this you can never know, really. And this is, we weren't chilled. We put in, you could be a pocket fisherwoman, but... But you don't know what will get you crossing the line, because laws are written in such a way to catch what they can. It's not like the law never says, don't say you're a pocket fisherman. It's you have no real way to know until you are afoul of it.
And one of the basis for the challenges to the law was that the definitions of what constituted a violent video game were unconstitutionally vague. And in fact, the state went into, and Merchant Prince is a perfect example of this, the state went into the case having to concede that of the two definitions they'd put in the law, one of them was on its face invalid because they had not left an exception in the law for historically valid and educational material. So something wasn't a case of violence, but you know, if they were going to rate the game as violent because you are assassinating thousands of people in horrible, horrible ways, well, that's kind of the way things were in the Middle Ages. And if you don't leave an exception for these sorts of redeeming educational, social, cultural values, then the law on its face has to be thrown out. And so they started off on a bad foot. They'd put two definitions into the law, hoping that, you know, we'll throw everything against the wall and something will stick, and they started off with half of their argument gone.
But then again, I find Grand Theft Auto historically accurate based on my driving to Atlanta today, so...
I mean, it's certainly educational.
That I might take two dealings.
I think the other really important issue here is the kind of the chilling effect aspect. I was actually, it was kind of interesting because I was talking to somebody recently and they were talking about ESRB ratings and they were like, but you know, what's the highest end rating? I'm like, AO, adults only. They're like, oh, is there a rating for that? I'm like, yeah, the problem is, of course, is that most retailers won't carry AO games. So, you know, there's no, you know, it's almost kind of like the old X rating or now NC-17 rating. You know, a lot of theaters won't carry it, so a lot of, you know, you just don't make movies for like that, except for, of course, straight-to-video movies. But, you know, we're essentially, the whole industry is, you know, the equivalent of straight-to-video. We sell directly to the consumer, either through retail, and if the games aren't going to be carried in retail, that can be really problematic for what kind of content we can provide to, you know, adults that theoretically can handle that content.
The interesting thing for, I'm changing topics on y'all. The interesting thing for me was that the entire point of the law was to try to equate the violence with obscenity. And as the Ninth Circuit went out of its way to point out, obscenity does not apply to violence. It only applies to sex and to other
killing people is
kids.
Fine. Making love to them is not. We all know that.
Seriously.
But the obscenity was, I think, one of their weaker ways to push this, for California to push this on through. I mean, that was one that was going to have a rough legs withstanding any sort of court challenges. We taking questions along the way, or?
I don't care. Whatever.
Go sure. For it. Oh, wait, you got to run a mic to him. Do you want to? Oh, cool. You guys are on it. EFF really
has. Have you guys ever seen the movie This Movie Is Not Yet Rated? Because it analyzes the entire MPAA rating scheme. And what's interesting is violence isn't really interpreted as anything. All they care about is sex. But it's an interesting movie because it's basically they look at every movie case by case, and there are no real standards. There's just a group of people who say, this is good, this is bad, you know, this is R, PG-13, PG, whatever. And how do we prevent the ESRB from, you know, falling into that same trap of not really having clear standards and
the ESRB,
you know,
will admit and has publicly admitted to not having clear standards. I've talked to them. They talk. We have sessions at GDC where they come on in. My brother Daniel runs the anti-censorship special interest group of the International Game Developers Association. We have a roundtable every year out at GDC, and the ESRB guys will come out there and admit to not having clear standards. They can't tell you what the standards are. They have their own standards, but they cannot share those with you as the folks are submitting your games to them.
We know it when we see it.
Yeah.
I mean, and it is a moving target because community standards change. You know, was it Temple of Doom was the reason there's a PG-13 rating at all? Mm-hmm. And, I mean, nowadays, that's really tame stuff.
And to be honest, the AO rating is not the most limiting rating. The most limiting rating is actually RP, which you only see on ads, which is ratings pending. Theoretically, that is the most limiting. And folks have talked about releasing games before the rating has been given and release it as an RP and see what happens. I don't know if that would do many people pretty well who aren't selling just off their own website, but... So...
One thing I wanted to mention too. The thing to remember about the ESRB and the MPAA with the movie ratings is that neither of these are actually mandated by law. These are self-imposed restrictions that are intended to hopefully avoid this kind of issue where, you know, the government tries to come in and say, okay, this is how things are going to be rated. This is how, you know, and then put legal force behind it, because as soon as you start doing that, you know, there's a difference between, okay, well, we think it should be like this, and the government saying, okay, here's a law saying here's what you can and can't put in.
Australia.
Yeah.
Germany.
Well, the German stuff isn't, German stuff is even weirder than the Australian stuff. More tenuous.
Yeah.
More nebulous.
You restrict most M-rated games.
Speak into the mic. Right. Always into the mic.
All right. I'm kind of taking a slight different direction in my question. As far as video games being looked at as into other cultures as a true art form, do you think that censorship could prevent that from happening over its development and time?
Oh, absolutely. I think the best probably parallel to look at would be comic books. And I really love a book called Understanding Comics by Scott McCloud. And one of the things he says about comics that can be applied directly to games is, as long as, you know, he says comics, but same thing with games, are looked at as a children's medium, any accusations of obscenity are going to stick. And I think that's one of the big, you know, if you look at comic books, you know, I'm talking to the right audience here. If you look at comic books and how they developed in the United States, and then you look at French comic books or, you know, Japanese manga, or, you know, and how, you know, those were able to flourish so beautifully without these restrictions. But then you look at the American comic and, you know, we're stuck with, you know, stereotypical superheroes in tights. And, you know, we really don't have that, you know, really, we didn't have that freedom of expression that other countries did, and they, you know, basically surpassed us. I think there's a very real possibility that the same thing could happen in games, where, you know, if Japan, you know, other countries obviously have their own restrictions, but, you know, if they have less, you know, if there's so much more fear in America of developing games, a lot of that development expertise and interest is going to go to other countries.
And there's a significant, well, not a significant fear in the industry, but there's a concern in the industry that we'll go through the same problems that the U.S. comic industry happened after Seduction of the Innocents. That significantly retarded the development of comic books as an art form, set it back at least 20 to 30 years, if not more. And We are seeing games, which most of us would consider art, whatever, regardless of whatever thumbs up, thumbs down guy says that games can't or can't be art. I can't believe I'm blanking on his name.
Ebert.
Thank you. Yeah, I blocked his name. He may say that games can't be art, but we are definitely seeing games that are of strong artistic merit, and don't want to see that knocked out. BioShock being forbidden from American shelves, or them having to take out some of the best stuff in BioShock would be a tragedy. But I think Blake brought up some interesting points with this. Were you talking about going beyond just the obscenity law with how California is trying to push this on through?
Yeah. Well, just real quick on the chilling effect on the art. Anytime you've got a law like this, where if your game is in California, if your game gets this rating, you've got to put I think it's a 2.5 by 2.5 inch label that says 18+ on the front of your box. And if you remember, you know, PlayStation box is only about yay big. So you've got to take up a quarter of your marketing space with this giant label. So now you've got the business and marketing folks bringing pressure on the art and development people not to have this content. I mean, let alone the limitation on who you can sell this stuff to. So that's, I mean, certainly that's characteristic of any time that the business incentives are going to drive the artistic development of the game.
Right.
As far as the obscenity, though, yeah, California's main argument there was that strict scrutiny, which is the test that's generally applied when the state is trying to restrict free speech, should not apply because this is a case of obscenity. And even though no court in the country has ever been willing to say or has ever been upheld on saying that violence is obscene, they're arguing, and their principal argument before the Supreme Court is that the lower test for obscenity is the one that should be applied, and that violence should be finally added to fall under the obscenity standards.
But there's a previous Supreme Court case you'll hear a lot talk about, Stevens v. something.
Oh, classic.
Which had to deal with visual depictions of animal cruelty, which tracks pretty well on this case. We've turned over two justices since then, which is an interesting question. But and Stevens is a good bellwether of how the Supreme Court's probably going to rule. And they ruled that even if there's just no redeeming value at all to killing animals on video, it's still protected speech. It's not obscenity. So
looks like we got a bunch of questions popping up.
What was the breakdown of the court decision for the California case? In the Supreme Court.
Oh.
It hasn't gone to the Supreme Court.
Yeah, the Schwarzenegger.
It's just for the ninth.
Oral arguments November 2nd,
something like that. Yeah, I think the Ninth Circuit, the 3-judge panel was unanimous,
right,
if I recall.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the Ninth Circuit is the most overturned circuit in the country because they're a tiny bit crazy, but at least one member of the panel is the most respected justice on that panel is Kaczynski. So, and he's fairly libertarian.
And remember, they're just following what pretty much every other court's done. Every other court is throwing these out as well.
No.
Actually, I gotta say, there is one pseudo games bill that has survived. It's actually Georgia's, and that's because the industry pretty much crafted it with with Thurbert Baker. So,
and on Stevens, it was an 8-1, and Alito had a dissent that I didn't bother reading. So,
that sums up Alito's credibility.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the chilling effect that you mentioned. Why wouldn't it also have the same sort of effect that you see with, like, cigarette advertising and, to a lesser extent, even music, when they added the parental advisory where, you know, it made it more appealing to children to say that you can't have this or that it's too mature. I mean, it seems that it would, by trying to, you know, ban it or make it, it seems that it makes it more appealing to an audience like that.
Because Walmart won't carry it if it has that label on it.
Think about how many Two Live Crew albums you've bought since Jack Thompson went after them. You got the one. You can't think of another one you picked up since
the business, then. If the business folks can't get it on the shelves, they're not going to want that label.
And the other issue about the chilling effect is it's not just what the audience wants and not just what will be carried. It's what will the developer put in, because it's just a big hassle to go through the ESRB and then have to take that stuff out later on. You can't lock it. We learned that with the hot coffee mod in GTA. You can't lock stuff away and hope he won't see it. You've got to take it out. Then you got to test it to make sure that doesn't mess up anything else. And you've added another month or two to your time, and Lord knows how much to your budget.
And, I mean, you know, this is a group that will get this joke. Who shot first, Han or Greedo?
Yeah.
The conventional wisdom is that the MPAA decided that Han couldn't shoot first or be PG-13, so Lucas made the change. So, chilling effect.
I think that also the other aspect of the chilling effect here is for a lot of small game developers. You know, I ran the game Rooney 59 for a long time, even though it originally had a ESRB rating. You know, I never updated it when I was running the game. You know, I'm developing some small. You know, you go to any Flash portal, you know, you don't see ESRB rating. But there's going to be a world of difference that between ESRB rating and then California law. All of a sudden, you know, do miners have access to this? You know, where's the boundary? Are we talking just about, you know, retail, or, you know, can a Flash
Steam.
Can a Flash portal that has some racy content run afoul of that law if the servers are hosted in California?
All right, your questions in back.
Yeah, I guess it's like a question and a comment. I kind of feel like a lot of this legislation is because parents don't want to parent their kids anymore. They are relying on the video game industry to babysit their kids. And so my question is that how do you socially overcome that or point that out to a large majority of people that are unwilling to see that instead of having your, if you don't want your kids playing video games that are violent, then take them outside and play with them. If you don't want your kids obese and sitting in front of video games, then you know what? Take them outside and play with them. It's just, and how do you guys feel about the fact that you guys are getting so much pressure to essentially build games that are, you know, meant to be a babysitter, if you will?
Well, I'll actually, I've heard that argument that it holds a lot of weight, but I'll actually argue that for games, the parents who are pushing it through are not the ones who don't want to worry about this for their kids. The majority of parents don't worry about this for their kids. They know that Johnny's not going to go kill people because they played GTA. If everybody who played a violent video game was out there killing people, we'd have a dead room right now. But it is, in my opinion, it's the parents who want to parent everybody else's children, too, who are the ones who are really pushing these through. And that's the biggest hassle. The parents who don't care about the ratings know that it's not really a problem. But there we'll have the others, and those are the ones who getting through to are will always be an interesting wrestling match.
I think the other thing is that, you know, I think developers can shoulder some of the responsibility here. I love telling this example of one of the most dedicated fans of the game I ran. He actually lives here in Georgia. I visited him several times previously when I attended Dragon Con. He has a kid that, you know, absolutely adores him, and when I went to visit, they actually drew like a little character, you know, little sketches of my in-game character, and but he still wouldn't let the kids play the game. Why? Because he felt it was too violent. And I said, thank you for that. I really appreciate that. You know, maybe I'm not getting a couple more subscriptions on my game, but you know, you are making the choice, and you're not relying on me to make that choice for you. You're active in your kid's life. And I think the other thing too we kind of keep in mind is that, you know, a lot of if parents do want to kind of help their children, you know, we need to understand and make sure that that's appropriate. Like, you know, MMOs, which I'm familiar with, a lot of MMOs now will include parental controls. I think that's important to include, and so we can say, look, we want to give you the tools. We're not going to dictate it, and we're not going to say, well, you know, sorry, laissez-faire, you know, whatever your kid can get away with, we're going to allow them to get away with. Give the tools to the parents and say, look, we understand you want control. We understand that you need to exert some pressure over your kids. Here's the tools to do it.
And here I thought you were thanking your friend because he was giving his child the motivation at a young age to become a great hacker.
No comment. Too many lawyers in the room now.
We have some other questions popping up.
You were talking about how there's not that many obscene or violent games on Flash, on sites with Flash games.
No.
I said if there were content that would run afoul of the California law, then what would the effect be? I think, I mean, yeah, there are a lot of, you know, if you go looking for them, there are a lot of really violent and potentially obscene Flash games.
Not that we've gone looking for.
No.
That's what I was saying. There's quite a few of those that I've seen, right. So I really don't think those have a rating, so I'm not really sure what that would happen.
Actually, I do have a question for the lawyers on this panel.
Uh-oh.
Theoretically, who would get in trouble for those? The portal? The developer?
Would it even be covered by the
law?
Whoever provides access. Under the California law, whoever provides the access to the game.
So it'd be the portal, essentially.
Yeah.
The parent buy the Xbox or the PlayStation?
Parents are never to blame.
Well, parents are specifically accepted in the California law. If a parent buys the game to give it to the game to the kid, that's specifically acceptable.
Because the parent at that point is parenting. I mean, they're making it, hopefully, a rational decision.
Although I think
an informed decision.
Or a decision.
Making a decision, we'll leave it that.
Although I think the text of the law is actually anyone who sells or rents a game.
So it is.
So if there's no exchange of money, I don't think the law would apply. So if it's a free-to-play portal.
They've only got jurisdiction over that if the portal is hosted in California.
No.
You access it in California, they've got jurisdiction over it.
Yeah. Because then you've had the standard is minimum contacts, and then the California long-arm statute comes and gets you.
This puts Steam in trouble, and that's one place folks have been looking to get around this. And the, what's the other one? The other download, the Steam equivalent.
Direct-to-Drive.
Direct-to-Drive, thank you. All I could think was Drive-Thru RPG.
I just got a question involving, is there any, like, I guess, company-wide policy or industry-wide policy regarding to where, if it got to the point to where you guys couldn't do anything, well, fun... Would you guys just, like, strike or anything? Or like, do you have, like, an ultimatum, like, hey, if you don't want us, we'll leave
no
and just go to
you.
Different countries?
Well, no, that is a very real one. And one of the most interesting things about the court case, not the law to me, is the fact that California has gone out to other states to get them to support this. And usually, as a friend of court brief, most of the courts will submit these. They're only getting 10. They're not even getting a majority, much less the 40 they usually get on these. The majority of states are not only not supporting them, but my understanding is they're submitting opposition briefs or are saying that they support opposition briefs. Why? Because there is so much money to be made, and every state, including Georgia, is desperately trying to get that business away from California. So everybody would love to see the developers leave California and go there, and all the states are very actively trying to do that.
Yeah, and development, I mean, game development is really international these days. I've done a lot of consulting and contract work, and for a while I like to joke that I was consulting with a German company that was outsourcing to China while I was still living in the U.S. You know, a lot of this, like I said, that you look at comics, French and Japanese manga, French comics and Japanese manga have exploded while the U.S. Market generally stagnated. You know, I think a lot of the hardcore developers would probably, if our livelihood was threatened, we'd probably look to emigrate to Europe.
Amsterdam.
So you guys were talking before about Walmart as, you know, being this hurdle. Like if you get a certain rating, you can't be sold in Walmart. But for small game developers who are, say, developing a mobile phone app, isn't Apple a bigger threat than Walmart? Because they have no real standards. They kind of have standards, but they just sort of make it up and say, this is good, this is bad, you know?
I just threw Walmart out as an example. Lots of the big, I mean, it applies to a lot of the different retailers who will not carry the games that have over such a mature rating.
Yeah, the PR fallout and then just the practical ability to govern the line between minors and adults, it's just not worth the hassle for them. And so they're just not going to do it, and you lose a lot of sales.
Yeah, and what Apple's doing with its own game policy is anybody's guess. So we can try and figure that out later. And really, the ESRB has done some ratings for mobile games, but with the huge explosion of iPhone games alike, they're dreading the day they got to start going through every single one of those.
I guess in a continuation sort of that, but also, you know, do you think there's a propensity for things like Steam to be able to circumvent sort of the stranglehold that retail sellers have on video games to, you know, obviously probably not now, but maybe in the future to equal those sales?
There are a lot of developers who are doing very well just by going through Steam and not going through traditional retail. There's a group here in Georgia, Tripwire Interactive. Anyone played Killing Floor or Heroes of Stalingrad? Yeah, good stuff. They're now in stores. They're self-publishing and they're in Best Buy and so forth, but they basically made their success because of Steam. They could not have made it via their model by trying to hit the stores and going through publishers the traditional way I usually did. And it is circumventing traditional retail outlets. Now, does that mean that Steam's not feeling some pressure to make sure they got ESRB going on? I'm sure they are. And we'll have, at Siege, we'll have the business development head from Steam there, so you can ask her that very question. But we would love to see stuff like Steam and Directed Drive mean that we don't have to worry about it, but they're going to feel those pressures too. And we get, you always get the complaints about violent video games in the media. They hit at Christmas and they hit on the anniversary of Columbine. So you get another incident, whether it's got any real link to violence in games or not, and those guys will start feeling the pressure.
I've heard the, when it comes down to who is actually trying to make the push for the lulls, I've heard a number of different, you know, groups being stated as kind of being the groups that's doing that. I've heard, you know, some people say that, oh, well, it's religious groups that ultimately really would like to have movies and everything else included, but they can't do it right now, so they want to go for video games. And I've heard some people say that, oh, well, it's a matter of one political group or another saying, well, we can get props for being, you know, pro-family. Who do you really feel is kind of the number one group in terms of that is really pushing for it and the number one agenda that is pro, you know, these laws?
Dr. Craig Anderson, professor at Iowa State University and the director for the Center of the Study of Violence. He's the big name within the psychology and psychiatry community who pushes the idea that violent video games do psychological harm to children. Of the...
He's got another life.
No, he's really is life. The guy.
The Ninth Circuit was talking about half the studies cited by California were Craig Anderson studies.
Of 10,000 study documents produced on behalf of the state, about half of them were authored by this guy.
But to answer your question, I think the real question really is more, it's not a group so much as it's the fact that politicians have no spine. And that for the children is... That's just great press. I'm protecting your children for you. Vote for me.
But politicians are making press by opposing pushing this forward. Both parties are guilty of this kind of crap. Hillary Clinton's done it, and we've seen, and now we got Schwarzenegger. We've had a lot of Republicans doing this. Schwarzenegger's pushing it through. The California Attorney General didn't want to do it. There was opposition internally, and that was, of course, Republican, Democrat, and there's not just some having a spine, but also want to embarrass the other side, that kind of thing going on. But, I mean,
I think everybody does. It largely comes down to kind of scoring political points, it's always easy to prey on the fears. I mean, I mentioned comic books, but you look at a lot of media in the past, and every time that new scary media comes along, the old generation says, oh, look at, you know, this thing corrupting children, whether it's, you know, theater, movies, rock and roll music, you know.
Jazz to rap to...
Right, right. And so any time that there's always this generational divide, a politician can score easy points and say, I'm here, like Andrew said, I'm here to protect your children. Vote for me. Unfortunately or fortunately, however you want to look at it, it doesn't fall along party lines. It's basically just, you know, convenience. You know, Democrats, Republicans, independents, they'll jump on the bandwagon if they think there's a political gain to be had.
And frankly, video games are a great topic for politicians, whichever side they're on, because as much as everyone at this convention probably cares about them, 95% of the population could care less, really, about this law. And so whichever side they're on, the politicians can make great press, and they can have press conferences, and they can put out white papers, and they can talk about it to their heart's content, and no one's really going to pay it that much attention, and it's not going to be a deciding factor in voting, but they can, I'm standing up for your children, I'm standing up for free speech, and... That is what is going to resonate with people, and the voters aren't really going to remember that it had to do with video games. And frankly, when it gets to the Supreme Court, I think that's going to happen. I think we're going to see 9 justices put out 9 opinions because, oh, we're lawyers and we get to talk about free speech on something that no one's going to read.
But you bring up an interesting point about the studies, because that is a major part of what California is pushing here, that these things are damaging to kids even beyond the obscenity idea. These things are physically, psychologically, etc., damaging to kids. And this has been pushed in laws before. Michigan was the most notable example of this. And the courts there said that those studies were invalid, couldn't be used. There's plenty of other contradictory stuff. Trying to base law on these studies was invalid. And I think that's one of the things that California is really pushing for on this, is its use of the studies to show that these are damaging and need to be regulated.
The guy with the mic talks.
Yeah. So. I have a question. Since, you know, video games are, you know, inanimate objects, they can't defend themselves. I mean, how much, you know, my dad and he worked for the CIA for 10 years. He has a background in neurology. We've talked about this in the past. How much of, like, America's obsession with political correctness and its, you know, and its inability to truly find the causes of crime in this country, I mean, how much do you think that plays in terms of just tacking stuff that can't defend itself, like video games, instead of, you know, putting aside political correctness and really talking about why crime occurs in this country at the level it does?
Well, I definitely think there's an issue that, you know, politicians like to be seen doing something. Whenever there's a crisis, even if the proper answer is not to do anything, politicians want to be seen as doing something. So they'll pass a law, even if it's meaningless. You know, I think that's probably the same thing, you know, related to what you're talking about here. You know, violence, you know, kids, parents always want to make sure that their kids are safe from violence and predators and all that. So if a politician can say, I'm doing something to help, even if it's not really helping, I think, yeah, I definitely think, again, because it kind of goes back to that scoring easy political points. And the fact that, you know, a majority of people, particularly in America, don't care about video games beyond just a kind of a cursory level. That helps our case, because, you know, now it's not going to get some people, it's not going to get a large group of voters fired up one way or another. They can make the soundbite, like you said, they can make the soundbite, I support free speech, or I'm protecting your kids. And
they can do it bipartisan, because both sides aren't, you know, Republicans are going to say this is causing crime, and Democrats are going to say that's causing crime, but they both can say, but we're banning video games, and we're being bipartisan about it. It's very convenient for them to do it that way.
And I'll go ahead and throw, in order to get more strife on the panel, get some violence up here, I'll go ahead and make the argument these are also sometimes what are considered lawyer welfare bills, because they know they're going to be challenged, and the state can go ahead and give the contract to handle this to a favored firm, and the firm can go ahead and make some your cash, your taxpayer dollars, defending laws that they know aren't going to stand up. Georgia had this with its sex abuse law where the sex abuser couldn't live anywhere in the state, essentially, and it was going to get struck down, but it was going to make some folks money along the way. Often anti-choice laws are exactly this. They know it'll get struck down, but a politically aligned law firm makes some cash defending it all the way up. But that's my conspiracy side of it, and I'm sticking to it.
How do I get in on some of this money?
Patent lawyers don't do well on conspiracy.
You have to be a trial lawyer. Okay, next question.
Have we already lost this battle on the next phase of platforms? We now have non-government entities deciding whether violent video games are okay on iPhones, on the next Microsoft phone. Google's getting a lot of pressure to do it on their platform. This is the next platform, and the government doesn't have to do it because Apple and Microsoft and Google are going to do it for them.
I'm going to take this on the legal side and let y'all argue the politics or the policy side. Legally, we're winning. The Ninth Circuit decision, and I think we all agree that the Supreme Court decision will probably be, what the heck are you talking about? They are not obscene, law struck down. So from a legal point of view, I'm very happy with the results and with what we expect the result to be.
But do you think that's going to pressure those companies to lower their filtering they're already doing to stop, you know, violent video games on those platforms?
I think to some extent it will, because nobody wants to catch a lawsuit and have to put out thousands and tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of dollars in the defense fees. But the nice thing about this law is that a coalition of large companies went to bat, so the pain got spread around a lot. And I think because we're doing that, it's not having as bad an effect as it could.
I hope you're right. If I can just say one more thing, I'll shut up. Microsoft, Google, and Apple have never struck me as non-litigious firms. I'm afraid of lawsuits, so I'm not sure. I believe it in today's climate. Maybe I'm happy to learn that in the next 6 months, in the next year, that changes. But today we can't get anything like a violent video game. Because I own my own phone, I can't be considered an adult on my phone. Because a child could one day buy or use my phone, I can't get that sort of thing on a phone.
I actually don't tend to think that Stevie J is concerned about the state laws when he's putting his dictums down about what you can get on your iPhone or not. I think that's him and his fears about PR. He doesn't want Postal 2 showing up on an iPhone at some point, regardless of Gary Coleman's presence in the game or not. But I am hard pressed to think that it's because of the law that he's worried about it. That's his own wackiness.
Yeah, the important thing to remember here, and it's important to reiterate this whenever there's a discussion, is censorship is the government restricting speech. There's nothing in it about private companies or individuals restricting speech. And I think, the best way to kind of get around this is, if there is a real demand for it, businesses are going to open up. But I think, I'm hoping that kind of what we've been talking about here, like, as the government, as if the Supreme Court says, no, look, this is free, this is protected speech, stop doing this. I mean, I think that's the best possible outcome we can get here. And then states will wake up and go, okay, yeah, sorry, if we've been stupid all these years. That might start opening it up, because then all of a sudden the public opinion might start swinging that way. Oh, okay, well, this is part of protected speech. Obviously, we should be there shouldn't be so many restrictions. We're going to go out and say, buying violent video games is fine. We're not going to, tar and feather Apple because some kid might see Postal 2.
Plenty of other reasons to tar and feather Apple.
Well, yeah. But, I think the thing to remember, too, is that, opinions change over time. It's going to take a long time before we see that. And Apple's probably not going to. Apple's not going to see. Supreme Court says it's protected speech. We're going to allow whatever game on there. They're still going to have their own personal, their own corporate reasons for the restrictions.
On the flip side, if five justices decide that the California law is allowable, you will suddenly see a bunch of these pop up in states.
Yeah, yeah.
But even with the ruling we have, there is going to be some effect on the industry in terms of what they need to do. And I'll try not to bore you too much with the legalese here, but I mentioned the strict scrutiny test a little while back. And part of the Ninth Circuit's decision was that this law has to be evaluated under this test. Essentially, the state has to demonstrate a compelling interest that they're trying to protect, and they have to show that the law they've passed is the least restrictive means possible to enforce that or support that compelling interest. The compelling interest, they argued, was video games cause psychological damage and may result in violent behavior later in life. The Ninth Circuit said, we don't buy your research. But even if we did, this is not the least restrictive means, because there's this ESRB thing that is providing these ratings, and so parents can already make these decisions for their kids. And if we find that the ESRB system is failing, then that leg of the argument gets knocked out.
It's not ESRB that's failing.
Well,
it's the parents failing.
Mm-hmm. Well, but
as a parent,
but one of our favorite person in the world, Jack Thompson's little stings. Remember, he'd go out and he'd send his 16-year-old kid in to buy violent video games.
Got turned down. Got blocked more than he was allowed.
True, but he was trying to show that the system's not working. And that if somebody can legitimately, and I use that word intentionally, show that the ESRB ratings as applied by the sellers is not working, then it's not a reasonable alternative, and the California scheme starts looking a lot better. So there's some danger, but not a whole lot, because they're crazy.
Okay, kind of a different topic. But the new thing that's really popular right now is the casual games. So do you think a lot of developers would, instead of trying to push violent video games, just decide that they want to start making, like, the next Cooking Mama or something?
Well, I personally find Farmville obscene, or at least I get it. But that's...
There is sex in Farmville?
what are you doing to those farm animals?
I mean, Zynga and Playdom have shown incredible profit potential out of the social networking casual side. Another game's done with casual, but the industry leaders we see are the ones who the Jack Thompsons want to go after. I mean, an EA and an Activision and Valve and so forth, and especially Take-Two, are still head and shoulders above them, to the point where it's nothing for EA to lay off a bunch of people and then buy Playdom. What was it, Playfish? Who they buy? Right after laying off a bunch of people, anyone bought
Playfish. Yeah.
Playfish, yeah. So those are the big players still, and the way we continue to see the market, we hope the casual is going to blossom a lot more. I'd love to see the casual market explode significantly, not in a violent way, in a growth way. But for the foreseeable future, it's still going to be the big titles. And the big money ones are Modern Warfare, the next GTA, BioShock. So you look at anything that's not Wii on the top 10, and you're going to see a fair amount of violence.
I think it's funny that the next panel is about Facebook specifically. But,
obscene panel.
I'd be interested to see what you guys think. I mean, I think the future only looks bright. We're on the verge of the paradigm shift that Brian was talking about with comics. I mean, in the next decade or so, more parents will be gamers than not. You know, more of us that grew up on Nintendo will be having children, and we will, you know, more people are exposed. You know, the Playfish, the Facebook games, the casual market, the iPhone games, these get more people to view themselves as video gamers, more people to realize that they can consume video games as adults. It's not just a child's medium. And in the future, I think laws like this won't even be conceived of as much.
Is the average gamer like 32 now or something?
Yeah, somewhere in the 30s. Yeah.
That's actually been true for a little bit, but now they also have kids. So. Yeah.
No, I think you're exactly right. I think that's exactly what's going to happen. I've written about this topic a lot. I published a couple articles. I call it legitimacy. It's, you know, you look at try to imagine California trying to bring this kind of law against film. Even ignoring Hollywood, you'd laugh to death because, you know, film, you know, violent films, you know, we've had violent films forever. Like I said, you know, there's always been some kind of big, scary media that's come along, but eventually it attains this level of legitimacy where, okay, now it's, in U.S. terms, now it's protected speech, now it's free speech, you know, now it's artistic expression. I think that, you know, basically what you're talking about here is exactly what's going to happen to games. You know, we'll get to the point where we will be viewed as artistic expression. And the frustrating part here is that it's a really slow process.
Generational.
Yeah.
Okay, and I'd hate to be devil's advocate on something, but recently Limbo came out. Not that this is a really good example, but it had the option of a no-gore option on Limbo. And do you see yourselves as using that and actually hitting consumers in their pocketbooks and offering a no-gore option, but make them pay additional money for the fact that you had to rewrite the program? I hate to be it, but it's true. It's America. It's the United States. We're based on consumption. So make them hit them where it actually counts, which is in their pocketbooks. And more often than not, they're going to choose to buy the original version rather than the edited version.
I don't know. I would actually think that what they would do, and I'm thinking actually in terms of Fallout, would be there's a normal version and you pay $10 for bloody
ultra gore.
Yeah, for
ultra violence.
Whatever the perk is, bloody mess. I mean, I really think that we're going to find is the businesses are going to find what the consumer wants, and if they can squeeze a little more money out of doing that for free or for extra, then, you know, StarCraft 2, you get a third of a game for full game price. you know, we're seeing that happen again.
And it's not the price elasticity that's going to change. You're not going to pay more for a game like that. So you're hoping you're going to sell a few more units by pointing on it that World of Warcraft has parental controls, EverQuest 2 has parental controls, et cetera, et cetera. So, and I'm actually in favor of that. I am all in favor of as much player customization in a game as possible. Whatever a player can control, I'm all about letting them control. And if that means... The funniest one I know about that was the German version of Command and Conquer. The first CNC, when it came out, Germany was not allowing you to show blood. And if you remember CNC, when you ran over the guy with the harvester, a nice little red splot would suddenly appear. So they made it green and got around it accordingly. So I would love to be able to have green blood in most of my games. Pardon?
Gray sweat, Mortal Kombat.
Yeah, they did basically the same with the original Mortal Kombat console.
So I love this. And that kind of art change isn't a big deal. Now, when you got as much blood as in Mortal Kombat, that probably was a little of an extensive redo. Yeah.
I'm probably the anomaly here in the group. I'm a homeschool parent, and I go to homeschool conventions. And I'm also an IT guy at a major university. So they immediately turn to me and say, what do you think? Should they have laws against this obscenity and the gaming? And, oh, the kids are going to see violent stuff. And I look right in the parents' eye, and I say, grow a spine. The parents are responsible. I have just as much responsibility to make sure that my daughter doesn't wander into traffic or wander. I wouldn't let her wander anywhere in the store, because even in Walmart, there's things that are inappropriate depending on the age and development level of your child. And it's your job to police them, and it's called work and parentage, and that's what they're supposed to do. I appreciate that you guys put ratings on the games, but just like movies, when it says PG, I see PG movies today that would have been rated X when I was growing up. Okay, so what I do is I go online and look up what happens in the movie and say, you know, that's just not appropriate for my child. I don't care what the rating is. So I applaud you guys doing this to help the parents, but ultimately it's our responsibility. So for all you parents, grow a spine.
I 100% agree with that sentiment. I was a teacher for 2 years, dealt with teenagers, so definitely have dealt with trying to figure out how to censor sensitive information from them, but also teach them about the real world. And I think the problem is, it's not just the parents' responsibility to censor things from their kids to protect them. It's teaching the children what is appropriate, what's not appropriate, and having honest conversations with them. Because if you don't have honest conversations with children, they think that the bad things are mystical and exciting, and this is the thing that we definitely need to do. And then we run into situations where the small percentage of people that do turn into psychopaths for whatever reason, that happen to play one violent video game in their entire life, explode into a huge situation, and then it's blamed by the entire community of video gamers. So it's a double-edged sword. You need to teach the children as well as the parents take responsibility.
Though personally, I'd like the same rating systems on games that we have for books.
Absolutely.
My mother-in-law she's retired now, was a librarian in middle school, and a parent would come in and would say, you need to take this particular book off the shelf, and her first question would be, did you read it? And 99 times out of 100, the answer would be no. And that's one of the interesting things I've seen in the California case especially, is the amount of misinformation that is being pushed out to ignorant parents who don't do the research, don't sit down and figure out what's actually in the game or the movie like Keith was talking about, but just take it at face value and go, in Grand Theft Auto, you have to go and kill a prostitute and take the money back. Instead of, that's kind of one thing out of an entire sandbox.
Killing the prostitute's okay, but what you do with the prostitute...
Yeah, the hot coffee mod part with your girlfriend, you're satisfying. How well you satisfy her will get you in trouble.
Well, the example was the prostitute, so I'm just going to leave it there.
I have some issues generally with the Ninth Circuit's ruling, but they did cite one of the best quotes on this that I think has ever come out of an American court. To shield children right up to the age of 18 from exposure to violent descriptions and images would not only be chaotic, but deforming. It would leave them unequipped to cope with the world as we know it.
That's why they call it child training.
And that was the Ninth Circuit's basis for, or one of the basis for striking down that law.
I think it really comes down to the fact that we really have some blame to put on the game developers, but really it's the majority of the blame really goes on the parents and the consumers who actually go out to the stores and buy these games. I mean, because really, it comes down to is the fact that the people that commit these acts, the people that go out there, it's their choice. It's really up to them as far as why these acts are committed, why the violence comes out, and they're just these people out there that have nothing better to do. I hate to say it, but they have nothing better to do than just try and find a scapegoat for them, and that scapegoat has to be a violent game.
When I worked at 3DO, there was it was right after Columbine. There was a pretty humorous email being sent around about the dangers of bread, talking about all these different statistics, like, you know, 100% of serial killers ate bread within the previous 24 hours before killing somebody. And you're exactly right. It's a scapegoating thing. You know what? And again, it goes back to this whole, you know, the new scary media thing. You know, video games aren't very well understood by the older generations in general. You know, it's the new scary medium. It's something, you know, and every generation wants to look for some reason why kids are out of control. You know, I mean, this goes back to ancient Greece. You know, every generation looks for kind of that scapegoat, and it just happens to be that video games is the one for this generation.
How about the dangers of hydrogen monoxide?
Exactly. There you go.
I wanted to build on what Blake said here a second ago about keeping children away from any type of questionable material until they're 18. And from personal experience, my dad had me watch Blazing Saddles when I was 13 years old. But he said to me before, he's like, okay, you're going to be hearing a lot of stuff that you shouldn't say in public, and this is why. And he explained exactly what satire was and why it was funny. And at the end, when you see all the, you know, cowboys getting horribly blown up, he's like, no, it's okay. This is supposed to be funny, but this is why. And so he was able to build on that. So I agree with you on there.
I have another question. Because anybody who's even remotely worldly knows that, you know, Europe is a very liberal society compared to ours, yet their video game ratings are so much harsher than ours. I mean, is there a reason for that? Because, I mean, it's kind of, you would think it'd be the other way around.
In general, America tends to be a lot more restrictive with sexual content. Europe tends to be a lot more restrictive with violent content. We talked about German examples before. They actually have laws against the depiction of violence against humans. This is why the blood gets turned green, because they can say, oh, it's not really humans, it's zombies or whatever. You know, it's always some excuse. But Europe is, like I said, Europe is much more liberalized about the sexual content. You know, when I was working for a German company, I'd turn on commercials and, you know, be shocked at, the sexual titillation that was in you know, primetime commercials. But when it comes to violence, a lot of countries tend to be a lot more restrictive about that. And, you know, you can argue the pros and cons of each perspective, but... Yeah, that's just kind of the realities you have to deal with.
One of the things I was going to share about when I was growing up, when I was about 8, my mother thought it was a very important lesson for me to watch Jaws before we went to the beach. So
didn't have to buy you a swim trunk that year.
And as a side note, by the way, unless you think my daughter grew up to be this overprotected in a little glass bubble girl, she's on staff here at the con.
Abuser.
I wanted to go back to what you were talking about.
Well, just
about.
For the hours you make him work.
When you're mentioning, you know, the legal threshold for the decision, I was kind of going to ask about, you know, I work at a law firm as an intern and reading some of the stuff about corporate liability and protecting children, and it seems that there's a huge threshold and hurdle that a plaintiff has to go over to prove that somebody was liable for emotional distress against them, but it seems that when the discussion comes to video games, it's incredibly low. You can go butcher somebody's dog, and as long as the kid didn't see you do it, it's going to be very hard to prove emotional stress, but to see, you know, blood splatter in a video game, they freak out.
But there haven't been any civil penalties given on those suits. Jack Thompson brought them against Doom back in the day, and others have tried it as well. mainly Jack Thompson, sorry, mainly Jack Thompson and other people working with him, and those have failed just straight out. Now, it does cost the publisher a fair amount of money, but Jack Thompson's only going against publishers who have some money so he can win some cash, he hoped.
But why are they so successful, I guess? It seems like a lot of these corporate suits usually don't even make it very far. They get dismissed pretty early on. But
they get settled pretty early.
Thompson.
No, they don't get in the game.
Oh, well, in games, but in general, they get settled pretty early because they don't want to fiddle with it. But the thing, and Blake touched on this briefly, is that the fight in this case is whether or not strict scrutiny, I can talk, was triggered. And it's because generally when you have any sort of restriction of speech based on the content of the speech, it is automatically strict scrutiny. And so that puts us way outside the civil range that you're maybe more used to and we're talking about. Because now we're into rarefy constitutional law. And if you get into strict scrutiny, you had better have everything done right or you're going to lose. It's designed that way.
I'm going to have to use an analogy to raise my question in the best possible way, but it seems to me that we're treated like, well, the IT crowd in high school by everyone else, but because they think of us as these, like, your stereotypical, you know, suit and tie going every day to a high school, and we're not the jocks, we're not the popular kids, that they can just push us around like we're nothing. Can we do anything just to tell them to shove it?
Put on a black trench coat.
Wait, that's bad. Bad taste. Bad taste.
Oh, I was in the Army 5 years. I can get away with it. I'll just take insanity.
Might I recommend homeschool?
I think the biggest thing is, you know, advocacy. I mean, you know, the EFF is a good, you know, good source.
Here, EFF.
You know, and of course, there's a, you know, speaking about video games specifically, there's a lot of industry trade groups. You know, maybe if you feel really passionate about it, you know, go find out what they need. You know, maybe you can lend assistance to that. And you know, maybe you can channel some of that frustration into something that can help. You know, but the game industry traditionally has been really terrible about dealing with politics and lobbying. I mean, we're starting to get a little bit better about that, but, you know, I think, you know, that's the way you get noticed in politics, is you go lobby. And so, you know, support the organizations that do go lobby Congress to try to kind of protect our freedoms.
We bought Utah.
And, you know, if we're a... what was I going to say? You know, one of our strengths as a group is that we're technically savvy. We understand a lot of things, including the internet. So that means we are better at organizing than all the people who go, I need to organize. What is that tubes thing I can use? I mean, so we should parlay our strengths into better effectiveness, make up for, honestly, lower numbers than some other groups.
Get involved with local industry groups like
Chamber of Commerce,
like Siege, the Georgia Game Developers Association.
Here.
You show up, if you're willing to do the legwork and write a letter to, say, you know, blank Mr. Member of the General Assembly, educating them on some basic points, you know, yes, we're aware that there's some concern over violent video games and how they affect children, but we wanted to make you aware that there's a lot of redeeming value, there's historical games, there's all this other stuff, and then you go to these local industry groups and you get 4 or 5 employers in said assemblyman's district to sign on to the letter, that carries a lot more weight with them than one letter from a constituent.
And remember, we are them now. Gamers are the majority. And to show you how far this has shifted, for Siege, the state of Georgia, the governor and the governor's office are some of our sponsors. So.
We win.
But what about not an election year?
Would y'all know why adults let kids play rated A games?
So adult games?
AOs?
Yeah. AOs.
There are so very few AO games that if the parents are letting them play it and they bought it, they've got their own. Oh, he's playing all AO? All you play is AO? Ken, you haven't shared any of those with me? I think that parents often have a strong respect for their children's ability to handle the issues that are raised. And they understand their children better than a state legislator does. And if a parent wants their child to play an M or even an AO, I will respect a parent's decision to do that as much as to not let the child play it.
Yeah, I agree.
Hacking. Yeah. Hacking. Yeah.
Learn valuable life skills.
I am sleeping my network. Hacking isn't
the best game is learning to hack and run defense at the same time.
I freaked out my daughter when I said, I saw what you posted on that board with such and such, with this alias,
I just wanted to recap on what Blake said, is that, you know, legislation is a very important thing because, you know, it's step one is taking away, you know, certain aspects that you want to do, and then the next step is, well, then when that leaves, opens the door for other legislation that, okay, if we can prevent anyone from this kind of video game, then we can prevent you from doing X, Y, and Z. And then it's no longer a democracy. It's then just it's a very government-regulated state telling you that you can and can't do certain things with your own body.
Yeah, I think there's a fear that if the California law's reasoning is accepted at the Supreme Court level, it is applicable to a lot of things other than games.
Yeah, if you start including violence all of a sudden in the definition of obscenity, and we've got 150 years...
Ban football. Get rid of the jock switch.
And we've got 150 years of obscenity law and court rulings that deal with obscenity as purely a sexual topic. But, I mean, if the Supreme Court, and I'll go out on a limb and say that the Supreme Court is going to uphold the Ninth Circuit decision. I'll make that prediction. And I think there are flaws with the Ninth Circuit's ruling, but I still think this law is dead in the water and toast. But if they were to accept California's ruling and put violence under the definition of obscenity, it's an earthquake moment in free speech and censorship.
It's going to be the First Amendment equivalent of the Heller decision, the Second Amendment decision that came down. It's just going to change the playing field completely. And it'll be a decade or two before it settles down.
Hi. My thoughts are all kind of muddled, so I apologize if this doesn't make any sense.
Sore hours.
You should be on the panel.
Oh, cool. I was interested in what the panel thought of some of the more avant-garde games that are using disturbing material or violent material to teach a lesson. I don't know if you know who Brenda Brathwaite, I think
Brathwaite
is her name.
Brathwaite?
No, we don't know her.
Yeah. I've watched her speak before at another event, and you know she's done this amazing board game called Train, which teaches a really sort of disturbing lesson about how you would act in a certain historical context. And do you think that maybe if game designers would sort of take the time to make educational sort of powerful games that do disturb you, do produce more emotional content, if that would help, if that would be something that you could point to and say, you know, but children can, sometimes children need to be scared in order to learn something about how the world works. We were just talking about several young adult books that deal with rape or violence, and they are scary and they're sad to read, but I think it's important for young girls to read things like that and understand that they can happen. So if we had something like that that became mainstream in video games, maybe parents could understand how it could be a powerful learning tool as well as something engaging.
Those are exactly the games that you need to highlight if you're doing advocacy at the legislature level. These sorts of things that are unusual. They're not, because I mean, if you go and you send a letter or make a phone call to a local rep, if they've heard of video games, they've heard of Warcraft, you know, they've heard of Madden NFL, GTA. They've heard of the ones that are listed as the violent games. And if you can show them, look, there is a lot more to video games than that, and there are these powerful, yes, they can be disturbing, but it's clear what these games are, and they are tools for parents. That is going to be one of the more powerful things you can do in terms of advocacy.
And I think one of the things that backing up Blake is the religious fundamentalist movement has started trying to co-opt games,
violent video games,
that too,
left behind
into their evangelism efforts. So you arrive when the Baptists are trying to do the same thing. Mm. So
yeah, who remembers when Judy Blume was controversial? You wanna talk about generational changes? But if you want a game that will disturb people on a very deep level, I actually think the most disturbing game I've seen out there, and the scariest when I taught game design, showed this to kids, they would get scared, was a game called Darfur is Dying. Has anyone here played this? Excellent game. Go play it. It's about trying to survive genocide in Sudan. And it doesn't show the blood and guts. It just you've been captured by soldiers as a young child, and you can extrapolate from there what's going to happen. Dysentery for all. But there are great games to use as examples of disturbing video games that teach excellent lessons.
Another.
Let me see. Hacking. I told you. Hacking.
I have people who can help with that.
You know, the difference with Train, though, is that it doesn't go to Walmart.
No, Train won't sell well in Walmart. Too many glass pieces for kids to swallow.
Why is the government so stupid in these issues?
That's a longer conversation.
Yeah, they reflect. Not enough of us to vote.
When you're older, you'll get to vote, and then it'll be your fault.
Remember that we just had an election here in Georgia, primaries. It'll decide who will set the policy for this state for the next 4 years. Important time. Lots of major issues going on. And we were surprised we got as many as a third of the people who could vote out to vote. That's why we have the... that's why we hate government so stupid, because only a third of us are doing it.
But at least I didn't have to wait in line to vote.
I did. I got there and there were four people there. I was upset.
Okay, I like that you're talking about things like doing the legwork of writing letters and embedding deep content, like educational content, into games. Stuff that would work, not just be, you know, correct, like agreeing with all of us. So I'm hoping to get some more tips out of you for stuff like that would actually work to change people's minds. So for example, I know there's a lot of video game marathons for charity, stuff like that, where you play a violent video game, but you're giving back to some charitable cause. Do you think stuff like that persuades government people that would normally disagree with us that gamers are nice, friendly people?
I'll use my own analogy on this one. Giving toys to tots is a great benefit, and when bikers come out and do their biker ride for tots, it is meaningful. It is more meaningful that you have about 5,000 bikers driving through downtown Atlanta, where all the legislators can see that there are 5,000 folks out there who will probably vote as a block when helmet laws come up and things like that. So it is very meaningful, but it's also more meaningful when the industry can show, look, we raised $1 million doing this. We have clout. So I think both the doing good is important, but what also stands out is the power that's behind it.
Yeah, another great example would be Penny Arcade's Child's Play charity. You know, that they, you know, who can argue with giving, you know, helping sick kids, you know, survive a tough time in their life? You know, you have to be a real cold-hearted person to say, no, you know, it's related to video games, so obviously it's worthless.
But also shows, I mean, the Penny Arcade can raise that much money shows how many folks out there care about these things. And every gamer who gives money to those is showing that power. That
in general, if you're a marginal group, you can be screwed over or ignored by the politicians. If you were mainstream, you're too powerful to ignore because you're a lot of votes. So the more we can mainstream gaming, the less vulnerable we are.
I know a lot of people come out with studies proving that violent video games harm children's psychological development and whatnot. What are your guys' opinions on, like, if people did more studies about correlating video games with like positive development and whatnot? Do you think that would be viewed as like by the general public and politics as just pandering to their own self-interest, or do you feel that would actually be helpful and assisting the cause of proving that video games do have value?
I think the negative reports get a lot more traction. I mean, you know, car accidents front page news, but you know, guys rescues kitten from tree doesn't, you know, barely makes a human interest story. I think that, you know, even if we did, you could, you know, get those positive stories out there. I don't think they necessarily get as much coverage as a lot of the negative ones do. So,
and I think also we need to educate ourselves. You know, the baby Einstein. Guess how long that effect, that Mozart effect, lasts in studies? 10 seconds. But it makes your baby smarter, they claim. So, I mean, there's an element, too, where someone says, oh, baby Einstein, you can go, you're doing that? Are you an idiot? Here's why. And you know, quote him chapter and verse, and all of a sudden the misinformation is going away instead of we're having dueling, misrepresenting studies.
When it comes to passing laws, the legislature is going to use whichever study supports the law they want to pass. I mean, California had 10,000 pages of research, including peer-reviewed journaled studies. Now the Ninth Circuit came down and said, your science is crap. Whether or not it's the court's place to second-guess the research that the elected representatives are relying on is a, you know, whole different political question. But the fact that the court was even willing to say, look, we know you did your research, and even the stuff you were able to come up with isn't good enough to support your case, I'm not sure that having studies on the other side, it wouldn't hurt, but I'm not sure it's a super efficient use of resources at this point.
There are studies on the other side, and the industry is really pushing them, primarily to show parents, hey, get your kids more games, it's good for them. That it teaches problem solving, it teaches teamwork, those sorts of things are coming out. So I think the more important thing is for game designers to do more games that actually teach those sort of things.
The tobacco companies kind of poisoned that well for us, though, admittedly, with their studies.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, industry-funded study. I mean, whether it's nut groups on one side or the industry on the other side, just go ahead and do the stuff that is good. I like to think that my games have taught throughout, and more than just how to spread the Black Plague.
How many of those studies were actually conducted on real children? Because there's laws that prohibit you from being able to, even right now the FDA has problems with the fact that they can't, a lot of the medication that they say is safe for kids, they don't know whether or not it's safe for kids because they can't do studies on children. So how many of the actual studies that were done for video gaming were actually conducted on children? So what was the population that they used?
There were quite, I don't have the population numbers, there were quite a few studies that did involve child research and development. One of the flaws that the courts pointed out was that these were all very short-term studies and recognized that the researchers, were working under a handicap and basically said, we don't have good studies because we can't do this research very well, we can't do it very effectively. And that's one of the big problems they found with the science.
No, just talk. Okay, I don't know how relevant this really is because no one pays attention to comedians, but have any of you seen Penn & Teller's debunking of the violent video game studies?
I haven't seen that episode. I've seen a bunch of others, not that one.
But I can imagine.
But there's a reason Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert keep saying, no, we're not journalists. They're the most watched news shows in America, and they're comedians.
You'll have to forgive me. I learned evidence from Barbary, so
Me too.
There are evidentiary rules in place that permit courts to, you know, formally rule on the validity of a scientific study.
Sure, right.
Are there any of those kinds of rulings in the record for the ones that California submitted?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the court went through and basically trashed everything that the state was able to produce. I mean, they really just reamed them on the science.
They didn't get to like a Daubert ruling though on this.
No, there was not an evidentiary ruling. Because the state was not necessarily, they had produced the reports to show this is the evidence we relied on in passing the law. Because the state has to show compelling interest, and the way they do that is they show we have scientific research that says this is a problem and we're trying to address it. The court doesn't necessarily have to accept the validity of the science to accept that the legislature relied on it in defining the problem. it's kind of a fine legal technicality there. But they did go on further and said, but you shouldn't have relied on it anyway.
Yeah, if we got into a civil trial, say, the evidence would, the evidence requirement would be that it was peer reviewed, that it was generally accepted in the scientific community. And that gets really interesting here, where you have, you'll have some disagreement in the scientific community, but this position is at least defensible, even though it may not be right. It'd probably get in, and that would eventually help it bootstrap itself up to some credibility, but you probably end up having dueling experts.
Yeah.
As a kid, I was 11 or 12, and I watched, we were into sci-fi, and there was this cool sci-fi channel in Florida, and we watched this thing called H-Man. By today's standards, this is a really lame sci-fi, if anybody's ever seen it. It scared the crap out of me, okay? And I was 11, and I'd seen lots of horror movies and stuff. Well, I didn't sleep good that night. Well, that's the issue of that, though, is there going to be content in a video game that's going to disturb a kid? Yeah, probably. Depends on the kid, okay? That's not the issue. The question is, why did we let them watch it? We would not get all bent out of shape that there was not some special rating for science fiction movies that'll scare the crap out of 11-year-olds, okay? We don't get upset about those things. Why are we applying that same non-rule, turning around and making a rule on video games? That just does not make any sense to me.
And to take that to a further degree, I think that that is a positive effect to have on people, especially in the case of being like Darfur is dying. I think you want people to leave that game disturbed and be disturbed in their sleep about it later on. It's a very disturbing subject, dramatically and very well done. So I would consider that a positive add on a game. Will disturb your kid.
I'd just like to say that I agree with you entirely as far as disturbed, but fear has driven us from as a species to where we are now. It's not a bad thing. Being afraid, being horrified. Honestly, I'd be a little afraid if somebody played at a young age, played certain games, and wasn't disturbed from them. And my question is backing up a little bit. If these guys are just basically slinging mud in our face, why can't we be like any other private organization or firm or whatever and just sue their ass, or sorry, for libel or slander?
Let the lawyers handle the libel.
Well, this
not easy.
Okay, in the specific context of this game law, it's not a libel. It's just saying a certain effect is there. We have some scientific evidence to back it up, so we're going to prohibit it. The more general question, which I think you're asking, is, well, it's not really defamation because they're not singling you out necessarily. And also, there's intentionally pretty high bar on defamation. You don't want to, playground fight to escalate to a lawsuit. But yeah, I'm a little surprised Jack Thompson never caught a libel lawsuit. But that also just goes to show how high the bar is, that people thought about it and decided it wasn't worth the hassle.
But I think I think Jack Thompson's the greatest example here. He did more damage to himself than he did to the game industry in the long run. He got himself disbarred. I mean, he was trying to make a career out of doing lectures instead of having to do real courts and maybe land a big damage suit at some point and the like, and failed miserably and disbarred, and we haven't heard from him in a while. Knock on wood. But in the case is same for politicians. If they put these laws up, it is our duty to go vote them out.
And to some extent, politicians do have immunity from defamation, especially when they're on the floor of their respective legislative body. They can say pretty much anything they want.
Well, we've kind of run out of time, unfortunately, and we got another speaker waiting in the hallway. So I want to thank our panel for an excellent panel. And also thank all of you for some really excellent questions. You can stick around for the next panel.